Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear part one of a three-part presentation entitled Human Misery in Today's World, co-sponsored by the Creighton Department of Theology and the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities. Today's talk will be given by Charles Austerberry, a professor in the Creighton University Department of Biology. His topic will be Human Misery and the God of the Galapagos, Reflections on Biological Evolution and Theodicy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 31st, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Wendy Wright, a faculty member from the Creighton Department of Theology and the holder of the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities.
Tonight we have the distinct pleasure of welcoming Dr. Charles Austerberry, who is from the Department of Theology. He's going to speak to us on Human Misery and the God of the Galapagos, Reflections on Biological Evolution and Theodicy. Dr. Austerberry got his bachelor's degree in biology at Kalamazoo College. He worked for a while for the Michigan Cancer Foundation and holds his PhD in molecular biology from the Washington University in St. Louis. He has taught at Creighton University since 1984 in the Department of Theology.
Biology,
what did I say? Theology. Well, it's not inappropriate because he also has a very strong interest in science and religion. And so the topic that he will give us today about biological evolution and theodicy fits with both theology and biology. Dr. Austerberry, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Wright. Thank you, Dr. Fleming and the Department of Theology. This is a real honor for me to have this opportunity to participate in this lecture series. Though unable to attend, I was able to see and hear the YouTube recordings of both previous excellent lectures, and I really appreciated that opportunity. The remaining topics also look fascinating. This series is certainly interdisciplinary, as Dr. Wright mentioned. Indeed, proposed explanations for human misery come from several disciplines and perspectives. At Creighton, as Dr. Wright mentioned, I teach a course called Science and Religion. All of Creighton's senior perspective courses, like Science and Religion, are interdisciplinary. I'm indebted to Dr. Eugene Selk of Creighton's Philosophy Department because we developed Creighton Science and Religion course together and team taught it for many years. Father Dennis Hamm also taught the course with us, adding his theological expertise. So though I am not a member of the Department of Theology, I appreciate the promotion there and really enjoyed consulting with my colleagues. Any philosophical or theological errors in this talk are my own, I assure you. But I hope I've learned some philosophy and theology from colleagues like Dr. Selk and Father Hamm, from students in Creighton's Science and Religion courses, and from the writings of scholars in diverse disciplines with something to offer concerning life's big questions, such as this one. Why does God allow human misery? Is suffering by humans and by other animals that feel pain evidence against the existence of God? For example, the God of classical Christianity, an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good God. Some people argue, based on the existence of suffering in the world, that such a God does not exist. Some of their arguments are quite simple, presented as plain logic. Either such a God exists, or suffering exists, but not both. Suffering exists, therefore such a God does not exist. Other arguments acknowledge that while some suffering is certainly morally justified, or biologically useful, there remains additional suffering that is pointless and unjustified. Of course, this raises the question of whether we can really confidently identify gratuitous or excessive suffering. Nonetheless, serious philosophical arguments that much suffering is pointless and unjustified have been made, and their conclusion is the same as that of the simpler arguments. The God of classical Christianity and perhaps the God of all three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, does not exist. How do theists respond to such arguments? There are several options. One can defend theism without attempting to justify suffering. Atheism does not win merely because there appears to be pointless or unjustified suffering. But one might wish to go beyond merely defending against the argument. One might wish to provide reasons why suffering in the world as a whole is morally justified and therefore consistent with belief in a good God. Providing such reasons is what we mean by theodicy. Many different theodicies have been offered, such as suffering is punishment for sin. Suffering turns us towards repentance, forgiveness, and redemption. Suffering is necessary if we are to have freedom, free will, or even a good world in which to live. According to the theologian scientist Arthur Peacock, the interplay of chance and law is the necessary condition for the existence of certain good eventualities and the, in quotes, natural evil consequences need not be regarded as either avoidable or as intended in themselves by God. Even God cannot have one without the other. Peacock would argue that development of finite persons who are self-conscious, knowing, valuing, moral, and spiritual requires epistemic distance from God, the ability to make free, real decisions, in other words, no mind control by God, a lawful and impersonal world with natural consequences without constant intervention by God to rescue us. In other words, no cosmic moral nursery school. Such conditions might not require evolution, but at least they are consistent with evolution. What kind of good do non-human sentient creatures have that might justify their suffering? A different sort of relationship with God? We really can't know. Some other reasons that have been given would be that suffering promotes that moral and spiritual maturity, or unless we experience some suffering, we will not appreciate its absence. We're not going to solve the problem of suffering tonight. But as a biologist, I've noticed that there are many aspects of human and animal suffering that can be informed by biology in general and by biological evolution in particular. The previous lectures in this series touched on some human behaviors that might increase human misery. Biology, including evolution, is certainly relevant to human behavior, but I'll be focusing on suffering caused by diseases and parasites, by the effects of normal aging, and by natural disasters. Insurance policies refer to some of these casualties as acts of God, which is kind of interesting. For want of a better term, I'll simply refer to them as natural. Natural is another loaded term, of course, but what I mean here is simply that natural suffering is suffering we don't normally attribute to human causes. My colleague Charles Brockhaus in the Department of Biology here at Creighton just returned a couple of weeks ago from a research trip to the Galapagos Islands. Dr. Brockhaus studies black flies. Let's take those flies as an example of what I mean by natural suffering. Black flies are hard for humans to like, but they like humans. We are among the animals that can provide blood meals required by female flies in order to reproduce. Dr. Brockhaus intentionally refrained from applying insect repellent to his forearms in order to assess the local density of biting black flies. Talk about human misery. But the temporary pain of insect bites isn't the half of it. There are other parts of the world where Dr. Brockhaus would not have intentionally allowed any of the local black flies to bite him, because in those locations, some of the black flies carry a parasitic worm. One of the common nasty results of being infected with this worm is permanent loss of eyesight. And of course, we could give so many countless other examples of what I mean by natural suffering. Given the quantity and depth of suffering in nature, should we believe that nature is God's creation, or that God is good, or even that God exists? These questions predate Darwin by millennia, of course. But after Charles Darwin, is the way we think about these questions any different than before Darwin? Now let's quickly review the theory of evolution. on the Galapagos Islands and in many other places during his voyage on the HMS Beagle, Charles Darwin made observations that helped him formulate his theory of evolution by natural selection. His theory states that novel heritable variations occur in living things. Today, we know that these variations arise because of mutations in genes and because of novel combinations of genes. Darwin's theory also states that some variations are more likely than others to be passed on to offspring, in large part because some variations make organisms more likely to reproduce in a given environment. Organisms produce more progeny than resources in the environment can support. There are winners and losers in the struggle for survival. Thus, over time, a larger portion of the population will have beneficial genes that make those individuals better able to survive and reproduce. If the local environment changes or the organisms migrate to different environments, the natural selection pressure will be different. Genes that previously provided the best adaptations might not be the best in the new context, while genes that the old environment selected against might be selected for in the new environment. Thus, over time, accumulated genetic variations may increasingly differ among different populations. The populations might diverge so much that eventually individuals from different populations no longer interbreed. What were previously subspecies eventually become reproductively isolated, separate species. The divergence and diversification that leads to new species continues, mostly gradually, over long periods of time, and is still happening today. That, in an oversimplified nutshell, is Darwinian evolution. So again, our question is, does evolution matter in our attempts to explain natural suffering? Some people answer no, because evolution is not the way God created living organisms. They say that biologists are wrong and that modern geology and astronomy are also incorrect because the Earth is actually only a few thousand years old. When God created the world in six consecutive 24-hour days, it was more than good. It was a paradise in which black flies were vegetarians. There was no suffering and no death. God's plan was for humans and other creatures to live in balanced harmony and to multiply just enough to fill the earth. All that changed when Adam and Eve sinned. Only then was the world cursed with unsatisfied hunger and other lusts, with suffering and with death. That's the so-called young earth creationist answer. There are young earth creationism adherents among Jews, Muslims, and Christians, including a small number of Roman Catholics, and a larger number of Protestants. Some theists accept a bit more modern science, at least geology and physics, if not all of biology. William Dembski, for example, acknowledges that Earth and its life are probably billions of years old. Dr. Dembski is on the faculty of Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, where such an old Earth is rather controversial. In his 2009 book, The End of Christianity, Finding a Good God in an Evil World, Dembski also argued that Noah's flood was local, not global. That proved too liberal for his employer. In 2010, under pressure, he clarified some things. He repudiated his suggestion that Noah's flood was local, writing, "As a biblical inerrantist, I believe that what the Bible teaches is true and bow to the text, including its teaching about the flood and its universality." He did not, however, recant his view that the earth is billions of years old. Here's another part of Dembski's 2010 clarification. Since, on the assumption of an old earth, animal suffering precedes the arrival of humans, the challenge is to explain how the effect, natural evil, temporarily, precede the cause, human sin and the fall. My book, this is Dr. Dembski's book, is an attempt to create conceptual space for the old earth position in light of Christian orthodoxy, which has always taught that the fall is responsible for both moral and natural evil. End quote. First, I don't think Christian orthodoxy actually teaches that Adam and Eve's sin is responsible for all physical suffering and death. In any case, how does William Dembski square such teaching with the fact that suffering and death for millions of years preceded the first humans? In his 2000 essay, Christian Theodicy in Light of Genesis and Modern Science, Dembski writes, God does not merely allow personal evils subsequent to the fall. In addition, God also brings about natural evils, that is, death, predation, parasitism, disease, drought, famines, earthquakes, and hurricanes, letting them run their course prior to the fall. The drama of the fall takes place in a segregated area, a garden planted by God, that is, the Garden of Eden. In this originally intended world, there are no pathogenic microbes, and there is no need for Adam and Eve to have an immune system that wards off these microbes. In the imperfect world, both pathogenic microbes and human immune systems exist. Yet in their garden experience, Adam and Eve never became conscious of that difference. Only after they sin and are ejected from the Garden of Eden do they become conscious of the difference. According to this theodicy, the effects of the fall work not only prospectively, that is, forward in time, but also retrospectively, backward in time. End quote. Fair enough. Old Earth creationism coheres with modern physics, geology, and maybe even some paleontology better than does young Earth creationism. I don't have time to further address Dembski's theology and biology. What's relevant now is that unlike the young Earth creationists, the old Earth Dembski feels compelled by science to reformulate theodicy, not to revise theology so much, but rather to preserve the theological position that all suffering and death result from Adam and Eve's sin. But what about those of us, unlike Dembski, who accept that biological evolution is a valid scientific explanation for how all species, including humans, originated? Does evolution bear on our attempts to explain human misery? Again, the answer varies. Some find that evolution undermines all theodicies and all belief in God. Others find that evolution aids in constructing theodicies and supports belief in God. First, take an example where Darwinian evolution is seen as deadly to all theodicies and to theism. The God of the Galapagos is the title of a book review by the Northwestern University philosopher of science David Hull, published in the journal Nature in August of 1991. Professor Hull reviewed Darwin on Trial, a book just published earlier that year and authored by University of California Berkeley law professor Philip Johnson. Johnson's book, by the way, essentially started the modern intelligent design movement and was very popular with many non-scientists, but very few scientists. David Hull's review was highly critical. I'm no fan of intelligent design theory, so I generally appreciated most of Hull's critique. However, Hull was especially annoyed by the obvious religious motivation behind intelligent design theory. Hull writes, "The problem that biological evolution poses for natural theologians is the sort of God that a Darwinian version of evolution implies. What kind of God can one infer from the sort of phenomena epitomized by the species on Darwin's Galapagos Islands? The evolutionary process is rife with happenstance, contingency, incredible waste, death, pain, and horror. Whatever the God implied by evolutionary theory and the data of natural history may be like, he is not the Protestant God of waste not, want not. He is also not a loving God who cares about his productions. He is not even the awful God portrayed in the book of Job. The God of the Galapagos is careless, wasteful, indifferent, almost diabolical. He is certainly not the sort of God to whom anyone would be inclined to pray." End quote. I sent a letter to Nature, which they published, expressing my two main objections to Hull's natural theology, or perhaps we should call it Hull's natural anti-theology. First, must the Creator's characteristics be so simply and directly related to the characteristics of natural processes like evolution? And second, pain, evil, and the apparent capriciousness of life were acknowledged long before Darwin. And of course, the Bible addresses these problems. Hull himself even mentions the book of Job, but Hull says that the God portrayed in Job is awful. Again, time does not allow me to delve into a Bible study, but I like Thomas Tracy's view as expressed in his essay, Evolution, Divine Action, and the Problem of Evil. Regarding the book of Job, Tracy writes, "We are reminded of the great forces and structures of the world, of sky and sun, sea and rain, whose powers we cannot master or comprehend. We live alongside creatures that seem admirable, terrible, and pitiful all at once. This is God's world, and we find ourselves in the midst of it, in no position to say just how it came to be or to judge whether, by our lights, the whole enterprise was a good idea." End quote. Has knowledge gained through science fundamentally changed the situation? Well, even among those such as I who reject intelligent design theory and creationism, accept evolution, and self-identify as a believing Christian, perhaps not surprisingly, even we vary amongst ourselves on how to relate evolution and theodicy. As a young man, Francisco Ayala was ordained a Dominican priest in Spain around 1960. He initially wanted to be a missionary and go to remote places like the Amazon. But, he says, during the last two of his 5 years of theological study, he decided to leave the priesthood. He became a renowned geneticist. Ayala now holds an endowed chair as professor of both biological sciences and philosophy at the University of California, Irvine. He has been president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and published more than 30 books, including Darwin's Gift to Science and Religion. In an essay entitled Evolution by Natural Selection, Darwin's Gift to Science and Religion, published in the journal Theology and Science in 2009, Ayala writes, "One difficulty with attributing the design of organisms to the Creator is that imperfections and defects pervade the living world. Religious scholars in the past had struggled with imperfections, dysfunction, and cruelty in the living world, which are difficult to explain if they are the outcome of God's design. Evolution has come to the rescue. As Aubrey Moore put it in 1891, Darwinism appeared and under the guise of a foe did the work of a friend. The theory of evolution, which at first had seemed to remove the need for God in the world, now has convincingly removed the need to explain the world's imperfections as failed outcomes of God's design." End quote. No, not quite end quote. Ayala goes on. "The argument has been advanced by anti-religious authors as well as other critics, that the process of evolution by natural selection does not discharge God's responsibility because God is the creator of the universe and thus would be accountable for its consequences, direct or indirect, immediate or mediated." "Yes," others would answer, "but a world of life with evolution is much more exciting. It is a creative world where new species arise, complex ecosystems come about, and humans have evolved." Now, end quote. If this were my science and religion class, I would ask the students what they thought of Ayala's approach. Personally, I like Ayala's approach as far as it goes. In Ayala's other writings, it's very clear that Ayala tends towards the independence relation between science and religion, where science and religion are considered, in the words of Stephen Jay Gould, non-overlapping magisteria. To Ayala, evolution is an aid to theodicy primarily because it has taken some questions off theology's plate, so to speak, questions that, according to Ayala, theology doesn't really have to answer. But questions do remain, and others have offered additional answers. An example is Georgetown University's distinguished professor of theology, John Huck, who directs Georgetown's Center for the Study of Science and Religion. Dr. Huck has written several books about theology in the light of evolutionary biology, including God After Darwin and Making Sense of Evolution, Darwin, God, and the Drama of Life. Huck finds much in Ayala's approach that he likes. In fact, I see no criticism, really, of Ayala's theodicy coming from Huck, but Huck's own project is more ambitious. Huck tends more towards an integration of science and religion. He does so carefully and thoughtfully, but also quite broadly and deeply. For example, Huck notes, and I quote, "The concept of continuing creation has long been part of Christian teaching, but it has not usually been a theme of great significance. So one of the great gifts evolution brings to theology is that it renders the notion of continuous creation more meaningful, perhaps than at any other time in the history of Christianity. The Big Bang is still happening every moment, and each day is still the dawn of creation." In Deeper Than Darwin, Huck writes, "Nature's contingencies and evolution's randomness are not indicative of a divine impotence, but of a God caring and self-effacing enough to wait for the genuine emergence of what is truly other than God, with all the risk, tragedy, and adventure this patience entails." In his 2004 Boyle lecture, Huck said, "It is Jesus' entire life and death on the cross that reveal to Christians the astounding notion that God is essentially humble, self-emptying love that gives itself away unreservedly to the entirety of creation." An evolutionary theology, I would suggest, must picture God's descent as entering into the deepest layers of the evolutionary process, embracing and suffering along with the entire cosmic story, not just the recent human chapters. If Jesus is truly the incarnation of God, then his experience of the cross is God's own suffering. By virtue of life's unbroken historical unity, we may be so bold as to assume that also the eons of evolutionary suffering in the universe are also God's own suffering." End quote. Huck takes the new atheist on directly in essays, books, and debates. He often summarizes his argument with a question: "Does the universe we observe after Darwin have, as Richard Dawkins puts it, precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference? Or can we say that the universe we observe after Darwin has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom infinitely humble, self-giving, promising love?" Huck takes the latter option. There is much more to Huck's process philosophy-based theology, of course, but I'll simply note that Huck engages what Ian Barber would call theology of nature rather than natural theology. A theology of nature, such as Huck's, begins within a faith tradition, in which in Huck's case is Roman Catholic Christianity, and then looks to see how truths about nature discovered through science can inform and enhance that theology. Huck's vision does not meet the theological requirements of everyone, of course. John Wilson wrote in Christianity Today in May of 2000, "Few readers who have struggled with the problem of evil are likely to find Huck's notion that," and then he's quoting Huck here, "all the moments of an evolving world are harvested into the divine experience in an ever-intensifying aesthetic pattern," end quote, of Huck. And then Wilson goes on, Few, he says, would find this more satisfying than the solutions that have been on offer since the time of St. Augustine. End quote of Wilson. But others, like myself, I would admit, find much in how to find very useful. Kenneth Miller, a noted Brown University cell biologist, expressed his views quite similar to Hout's, I think. Evolution was much more than an indirect pathway to you and me. By choosing evolution as his way to fashion the living world, he emphasized our material nature and our unity with other forms of life. He made the world today contingent upon the events of the past. He made our choices matter, our actions genuine, our lives important. In the final analysis, he used evolution as a tool to set us free. Well, let me conclude my prepared remarks with a brief summary of where I stand on these issues, and then we can have some discussion. First, it's clear to me that most questions about theodicy existed in some form before Darwin. The degree to which evolution has any implications completely new for theodicy is limited. But evolution can inform our theology, including our theodicy, in ways that should better reflect the reality of the world as God's creation and the reality of the Creator. Second, evolution is solid science, and it certainly does inform our understanding of the world and of ourselves. It should be widely taught in schools in a manner that honestly acknowledges that there exists a variety of philosophical and theological implications. Different people have drawn from it, including those relevant to explanations of human misery. Third, I don't know, and I don't expect to know in this mortal realm, much about God or why God allows natural suffering. I hold in tension the acceptance, on the one hand, of suffering and physical death as natural aspects of evolutionary creativity, while on the other hand, agreeing that sin and death, in the sense of separation from God, are evils that have been conquered through the work of Christ. Exactly how redemption works in light of the world's past and future evolutionary prospects is something I expect to ponder for a long time. I appreciate insights from not only Roman Catholic and Protestant traditions, but also from church fathers emphasized more in the Eastern Orthodox tradition. I'm all for unity, but not uniformity. I think it's good that there are many Christian denominations with different emphases. To me, that diversity gives Christianity robustness, not unlike that of a healthy biological ecosystem. And finally, I'm absolutely convinced that unless greater harm would result to individuals, we should always alleviate human misery as much as possible. I disagree with any theologized social Darwinism, which might argue that since God creates through evolution, it's God's plan for only the fittest humans to survive. In fact, I think we will be much better off collectively and individually only if we do all we can to help those with, for example, genetically inherited disabilities or disease predispositions. Well, thank you for your attention, and I would be happy to take questions.
We have lots of questions, I'm sure, that we'd like to discuss, and I'm going to hand the microphone over to Dr. Fleming. And please, if you have a question, use the microphone because we're being taped. Thank you.
I've forgotten exactly what the author is you're referring to when this came up, but the argument was that because Jesus suffers, therefore God suffers. And there's a very ancient tradition in Christianity says that God is impassible. Mm-hmm. God cannot suffer. Indeed. That would mean God is not God. So how do you, is it you just have a different perspective, or how do you sort that out? It's a part of the theodicy question.
Absolutely. I understand the question. And I'm sure Dr. Hout and others who take the view that God is not impassible, that God, in fact, is, while transcendent, also so imminent that God suffers. Of course, even in the classical tradition, there's no question that one of the three persons suffered. And I guess what John Hout and others are doing is extending that to the whole of the Godhead and not just limiting it to Jesus Christ. And I'm not a theologian and not equipped to really respond nearly as well as many others in this room would to that very good question. I guess to me, I find Hout's argument somewhat compelling. In other words, it's not clear to me, reading the scriptures as a whole, that God is so isolated as perhaps the classical tradition would suggest. I think there are certainly some scriptures that are used to support that impassible, incapable of suffering idea. But I think there are other scriptures that would argue otherwise. So, again, I don't have time to get into that, but it's one of those several areas where I think in the biblical tradition there are multiple perspectives. That's my view.
Do you think morality is something that is a byproduct of evolution or that comes from divinity or that something else entirely?
Another very good question. Certainly, biologists, in particular evolutionary biologists, and even neurobiologists and others have gotten into that very question. Can we, or should we, root our ethical systems in our purely physical, biological nature? And I think there's no doubt that there's a lot of important insights to be gained from looking at animal behavior, for example, especially our nearest relatives. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that we humans are also animals, we are primates, and we evolve from common ancestor that's shared by some of the currently living other great apes. And if you go back in the tree of life, we're related to all the other life forms. And so there's no question that our physical brain and our nervous system and other aspects, in fact, of our bodies will impact our capabilities for morality. Certainly, in my opinion, we don't hold animals at the zoo or anywhere else morally responsible for attacking people that get in their cages at the zoo or wander on a trail and get attacked by a wild animal because of that distinction between animals and humans. We can anticipate consequences and put ourselves in the shoes of other beings in a way that presumably animals cannot. So in a sense, our biology itself, being different in some ways, we're very similar to animals, but different in important ways, is an underpinning for our moral abilities. But I think your question is getting at, is there something outside of that that is actually even required to found a moral system? And without that, is it really on sand? Is it not going to stand? And I know that's a concern of many people when they, think about evolution. I don't think it is a concern in terms of being a threat to morality, but unless you abuse or misuse evolutionary theory. As to whether there's something outside of that, I am taking very seriously the words of, say, Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI, both of whom have, in some of their writings, made the point that we have to decide whether in the beginnings, in the real beginning, in the absolute sort of ultimate sense of beginning, what came first? Was there some kind of reason with a capital R? Or was there just the brute material universe? And as a theist, I believe in the former. How that gets translated, though, into human morality, I'm still trying to work out. But that's not, again, a very satisfying answer to your question, but it's a great question, put it that way.
One of the most interesting things I've read on this subject was a little book by N.T. Wright. I even forget the title of it now. But the thesis is rather simple, what he comes up with. He's a biblical scholar, and he said, you know, to be quite honest, the Bible as a whole does not answer the philosophical problem of evil in a philosophical way. It doesn't give that kind of answer at all. What it does give is a narrative about giving us the story of God finding no way to solve this situation of the rebellion of the noblest of the creatures among his creatures, except to get involved in the incarnation. So God's answer is not a philosophical answer, but simply getting involved out of love. What do you think of that?
I like that. I like a lot of N.T. Wright's writings. I think what he has to say about the resurrection, for example, is very important. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Osterbury, would you consider animal suffering and human suffering as equivalent or on a continuum, or do you think that there is something that comes, human suffering is sort of qualitatively different than animal suffering? Mm.
Very good question. Boy, I would be hesitant to give any kind of final answer to that. Studies with chimpanzees especially, and also some cetaceans, some whales and porpoises and such, continually surprise us with the unexpected intelligence and sensitivities, really, of some of our fellow animals on this planet. There are very valid arguments to suggest that we really should put an end to experimentation on at least the great apes, the chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans, perhaps. I think, if anything, we have tended to underestimate. Certainly, we sometimes anthropomorphize, you know, and project our thinking onto some other creatures, but overall, I would tend to think, just looking at the research, we've tended to underestimate what's going on in the minds or brains or whatever of these other fellow inhabitants of this planet. And I think because of the rapid expansion of our cerebral cortex, what might have been initially a quantitative difference between humans and other animals, or our human ancestors at least, or pre-human ancestors and other animals, is now, I would argue there is a qualitative difference. In other words, I have not been at the forefront of, say, some animal rights movements that would really consider it speciesist, I guess, to make any distinction. in the ethical or moral or other value of humans and non-humans. But I would say I'm open to the question, but I think there's enough of a difference that, you know, when Christ said we're more value than many sparrows, I don't think that meant God doesn't care about the sparrows. I think Hout, especially, and many others have really pointed to the idea that God cares greatly about all of creation, and especially all of life, and that in some sense the redemption will involve more than just humans. But still, I think there is a significant difference. Whether that bridges over from quantitative to qualitative, I guess I keep weaseling around these questions, but I'm not going to take a stand.
Now, this is an issue that you said from the beginning you weren't going to touch on, but I'm really curious, as I think a lot of people are, in the unnatural, we would say, suffering that we have on Earth. And I was just wondering if you can recommend any books or any scholars who are particularly interested in this and who offer explanations for this sort of suffering.
So
this sort of morally
moral
caused
evil, the problem, yeah, of moral evil.
And then a theodicy that can explain this.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. I mean, I think most of the philosophers and theologians that I've read that have dealt with theodicy have not done what I did and sort of just focus on natural. That was a little bit of a cop-out on my part, but after all, that's not my area, so I felt it was okay. But indeed, those scholars that write on this, study this, they definitely include that. So Thomas Tracy, Hick, what's his first name? John Hick. Those are two of the top people that I'm aware of in preparing theodicies. Mm-hmm. And I have in my office some more resources I'd be happy to share with you. But those are the two that come to my mind as been most helpful to me.
And I guess a follow-up to this, along with the question you just answered, do you think that the issue of unnatural suffering for animals, you know, say in the way we do our factory farming,
yeah,
now, or experimentation,
yeah,
as you mentioned, can you qualify that along with human suffering, since we are in some way at fault for that? Although it's animals involved, it is sort of a moral issue. I'm just, how do you compare, like, the suffering of a pig to the suffering of a great ape
mm-hmm,
in a laboratory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I do think there is, it does matter what kind of, you know, cerebral cortex and other brain parts that animal has. And there's probably other aspects, too, of the biology that makes a difference here. But boy, you know, if there's anything in biology, it's clear that it's very hard to draw lines. It seems to be more of a continuous spectrum, usually, across various axes, including this one of the intensity of pain that might be suffered. And, you know, the animal care committees that approve protocols for research in biology, and I think there's similar ones, of course, in psychology with humans, but for animal research, you know, there are distinctions made whether the animal has a backbone, is a vertebrate or an invertebrate. And you get into some very puzzling, almost, you know, ironic situations sometimes. You know, you're housing your snake and you've got to feed it live mice, and so do you do a protocol on the mouse or the snake?
And you can be trained to kill mice but not to handle live monkeys.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think clearly if someone is careless or even intentionally harming animals, there's obviously a very clear correlation between that behavior and immoral behavior towards fellow human beings. So I do think the experience of our life tells us that it's all of a piece. Charles Darwin, for example, was often criticized. And if you go to anti-evolution websites, you'll see him painted as just some terribly insensitive, evil ogre who got joy out of torturing animals or something. The fact of the matter is just the opposite. He went way out of his way to avoid even inflicting pain on earthworms. And yet, it's also true that he loved to go hunting. He was most fond of shooting rats. Now, maybe we could think it's okay, but I don't think the rats felt that was okay. But, you know, I think given the amount of suffering and death in the natural world, and given the potential for alleviating some of that suffering through research, the need, in some cases, to probably consume meat. I've known vegetarians who were told by their doctors they really had to start consuming meat because of some other medical condition that made it required. But I respect those who are vegetarians for whatever reason they are, but I don't feel it's immoral to raise pigs and cows and sheep and have animal agriculture. I think it could be done in a more humane way. And I think it's kind of interesting how often if you do handle animals in a more humane way, you often get a better food quality product, you know? There's a lot of interesting correlations there. But again, I'm not giving any sort of tidy answer, but those are my thoughts. Thank you.
This is more of a social question. Looking at this issue of the resistance to teaching evolution in the schools, particularly in the U.S., it seems like over the last 10 or 15 years, there was more of a vocal resistance to this. There had been just as strong of a resistance for some time, but it seems like it became at least more in the news. Have you gotten a sense at all that this is changing? Is this becoming more of an issue? It seems like we hear about it a little bit less maybe in the last few years. I'm wondering if mm-hmm. this is a cyclical kind of thing mm-hmm. that you've seen, you know, in studying this or.
That's a very good question. I have also sensed that there's been a change in the last few years. Now, it's certainly not a complete change. Even as we speak, there are about four or five states, again, with anti-evolution bills in the legislatures at the state level. Some of those are neighboring states. Some are states you wouldn't expect to have that come up. But to me, the main change I've seen in the last few years is the visibility of Francis Collins. In my experience, until Francis Collins, who you may know, Dr. Collins is the director of the National Institutes of Health. Prior to that, he was the director of the United States Genome Project that sequenced the human genome. Prior to that, he was a very successful human genetics researcher at the University of Michigan. He's spoken here on this campus, I think, at least once, I think more than once. A remarkable individual, but Francis Collins is, I think you would say, an evangelical Christian who's also undeniably one of the most successful scientists alive today, at least in biology and genetics. He's an MD and a PhD, I believe. Scientist, physician scientist. And he has spoken out on the compatibility of evolutionary science, evolutionary biology, and Christianity. And he founded, with some others, a website, which I always refer people to as the best single website for getting information from those who view evolutionary science and religious faith as compatible. And that is BioLogos, biologos.org, BioLogos.org. In my experience, until Francis Collins, the conservative Christian community that is most strongly anti-evolution simply didn't trust the scientists. They honestly felt that the scientists were either themselves biased towards atheism, or they were cowed or tricked into accepting this phony data for evolution foisted on them by the atheists. But with Francis Collins, it was really impossible to say that. You had someone who was genuine and who spoke the language of evangelical Christianity. And others have come out of the woodwork to ally with him. And in some cases, it's cost them their job at conservative seminaries and pastorates of churches, etc. But I think there's a lot of progress, actually. And I think I've detected what you're seeing, too. Good question.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Arsterberry. Would you please join me in thanking him again?
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the first of a three-part presentation entitled Human Misery in Today's World, co-sponsored by the Creighton Department of Theology and the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities. Today's talk was given by Charles Austerberry, a professor in the Creighton University Department of Biology. His topic has been Human Misery and the God of the Galapagos, Reflections on Biological Evolution and Theodicy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 31st, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next program in this special series of talks on human misery in today's world can be heard next Monday, August 13th at 12 noon. At that time, the speaker will be Amy Wendling, Assistant Professor in the Creighton Department of Philosophy. Her topic will be, Is Suffering Emancipatory? Marxist Reflections on Human Suffering. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.